if you're an artist, why would you want to be a mathematician? If you're a mathematician, why would you want to do something that doesn't use those skills? So, and then find a calling that you feel off the charts passionate about, that's grounded in your fundamental beliefs and values, the somehow will b make believe will make the world a better place. It's tough in business or any endeavor to be successful, but if you believe the world needs this and it's grounded in how you're wired and your fundamental beliefs and values, it stands much more chance of succeeding.
Welcome to another episode of The Brand Called You, a podcast and podcast show that brings you leadership lessons, knowledge, experience, and wisdom from hundreds of successful individuals from around the world. If you're new to our channel, please consider subscribing to it and hit the bell icon so that you never miss an update. I am your host, Ashutosh Garg, and today I'm privileged to be in conversation with a very, very successful entrepreneur from the US, Warwick Fairfax. Warwick, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Ash. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Warwick is the founder of Crucible Leadership. He's been hailed by Forbes as offering compelling insights for anyone who would like to wake up feeling inspired by their work but doesn't, and that happens to lots of people lots of times. He's from the Harvard Business School. He's a certified coach, and he has his own podcast titled Beyond the Crucible. So, Warwick, let's talk a little bit about your early journey, and I was reading about you. You had a multi-billion dollar business as a fifth generation family member, and you said that you lost the whole thing. Tell me about this journey.
Yeah, it's quite the journey. So I'm from Australia, which is a pretty young country, but yeah, I grew up in a 150-year-old family media business that was very large, had newspapers, TV, radio, magazines, and I prepared myself my whole life to go into it. Did my undergrad at Oxford, like some other family members. Worked on Wall Street, went to Harvard Business School, and I came back at age 26, and in my youth and naivety and idealism, when you're young, you tend to feel like you kind of know everything, believe it or not. And sometimes you do, and sometimes you don't. I launched this $2.25 billion takeover, ostensibly because I felt like the company wasn't being managed well and run along the ideals of the founders. So it pretty much went wrong from the start. Other family members sold out. We had too much debt. And 3 years later, when Australia got in a recession, the company went bankrupt. So here I was trying to preserve the company, in a sense, bring it back to the ideals of the founder. And my youth naivety and, frankly, stupidity, it kind of all went wrong. So that is the short story. So it was pretty spectacular, I have to say.
So tell me, from a feelings perspective, how did you feel, losing such a family jewel? And what were some of your learnings?
Well, I mean, it felt terrible because family was important to me. I mean, not everybody's like this in Australia or the US, but for me, this whole family heritage, I felt it was my duty to go into the business, to preserve it, to, honor my parents. My dad had sort of another bit of a side tale, but he was removed by some other family members 11 years before this takeover was launched in 87. So there was a sense of, a good man not fairly treated and so on. It's your dad and, all these emotions. So I felt like I let my dad down, my ancestors down, hurt family feelings. Yes, I lost, in theory, I suppose, billions when we weren't on the street, but money has never been a huge driver for me, but it was a sense of there was this birthright and I destroyed. And it was brutal in terms of self-respect. It was sort of decimated on a lot of levels. In terms of your other question about learnings, I guess the biggest one is you can't inherit a vision. I mean, the company was founded by a person of great faith, my great-great-grandfather, John Fairfax. I'm a person of faith. And he had this notion that he wanted to have a newspaper that, sort of was a voice for the young colony of Australia back in the 1800s. It was, he treated his employees well. I mean, he was founded by as good a businessman of faith that I know. So it was a very honorable vision. I mean, what's wrong with having a newspaper that doesn't try to be partisan and tries to be a service to the community? A noble vision it wasn't mine. I'm a bit more of a reflective advisor. I'm not a media tycoon type. So that was the biggest lesson. It was a noble vision, but it wasn't my vision and I wasn't cut out to be in it. So beware of pursuing a noble vision that's not yours, that you're not equipped to fulfill, because you will almost certainly fail.
But tell me, you know, as a fifth generation, you know, person coming into a large family business, how do you expect to change the entire vision? I mean,
well, yeah, I mean, you can't really. It was more to, you know, and whether it needed to be done. I mean, I felt like management was making some poor decisions and a lot of things going on. So it was more to bring it back to the founder and my dad. Before he was old, he was in his 80s when I launched the takeover soon after he died. So it was more, you know, he felt like it wasn't being run as well as it should have been, but it was more to restore the vision. But whether it needed to be restored is a whole nother thing. One can speculate. Maybe my analysis of the problem wasn't right. But yeah, it was, you know, changing something like that when other people think it's fine. I mean, would have been almost impossible, because everybody else is like, well, I didn't get what you're saying, Warwick. The company's profitable and things are fine. And so, yeah, I mean, it was a hard ask.
I understand. And you also state, when I was reading about you, that one of my biggest mistakes was trying to be who others wanted me to be.
Right.
The question to you is that, how do you overcome strong parents or strong lineage?
Well, it's very hard, especially when there are expectations. And my mother was a very strong-willed person. My father, a bit more shy, introverted, but he was strong-willed. And if I hadn't gone into the family business, it would have devastated them. It would have felt like betrayal. And since I loved them both, you know, there's no way. The only way I could have gotten out of that family business was the way it happened, going bankrupt. It's my duty. I mean, I felt like what I wanted to do was irrelevant. Also about duty, honoring my family. It was just impossible. So I think really it's tough. You have to have tough conversations with your family saying, look, I love you, mom, dad, grandma, grandpa, but this isn't for me. I'm not being true to myself, my own skills, and I want to do something else. Now, if you have parents that really love you, it will be family first, business second. So part of it's on the parents. You might want to preserve the dynasty, but what's more important, preserving the relationship or the dynasty? So long as your son or daughter is happy and doing what they love, isn't that more important?
Correct.
So it's on kind of both the parents. You know, put your relationship before the business would be one way of looking at it.
Amazing. So, you know, born with a silver spoon, lost everything. How did you gather the strength to pivot and restart life in the U.S.?
Well, I think faith has always been important to me. So I had to rethink my faith, because the founder was a person of faith. I was a person of faith. I felt like, oh, it must be God's plan to kind of restore the company and the ideals of the founder, and obviously understanding whatever religious or philosophical heritage you have, understanding what the creator's plan is fraught with danger. I mean, who knows? So I think part of, and from my faith perspective, it was God loves me unconditionally. And so he didn't need my stuff or achievements. You know, it's not, so that was a cornerstone. And also, my wife's American, who I met in Australia, and just her unconditional love. She didn't, I mean, we weren't on the streets or anything. We were fine. It just, you know, a few billion dollars, you know, less wealthy. But, and then other than family, my wife and my kids, finding something I could do and frankly not screw up, something that I actually was talented at. So all of those three things, my faith, my family, and finding something I could do well, they were all building blocks to recover my self-esteem. But it wasn't like overnight. It was years. So, yeah, long road.
And then you came to the U.S. and you started Crucible Leadership. Tell me about this venture.
So, basically, Crucible Leadership is all about people helping people recover from failure and setbacks, which obviously I understand at least the failure part. And kind of living what we call a life of significance, which means a life on purpose, dedicated to serving others, because it's our proposition. The joy and fulfillment comes through living a life on purpose, however you define it, and serving others. So that was really, that's sort of the vision and where it grew out of. We go to a church in Maryland and the pastor asked me to give a talk on what I went through and maybe some lessons learned. And when I found somehow that what I was talking about helped others, it's like, how could, there weren't any other failed media moguls in the congregation that I know of. Mm-hmm. But somehow when you're vulnerable, you talk about how you bounce back from failure and setbacks. Everybody, even young people, they either have gone through a failure or setback, or if they haven't yet, they will. Mm-hmm. So how do you bounce back? How do you not let your worst moment define your life? Mm-hmm. So that's kind of what we're about.
Fascinating. And you also mentioned what I, you know, mentioned right at the beginning. You offer compelling insights for anyone who would like to wake up feeling inspired by their work but doesn't. Tell me more, and if possible, give me an example.
Yeah, I mean, it's really, you know, your worst day doesn't define you. You can live a life significant to life on purpose, dedicated to serving others. So we have a podcast, Beyond the Crucible. We've interviewed over 50 people from every part of the world, gender, race, every kind of setback and failure you can imagine. Well, one business guy I can think of, Hank McLarty, he was in finance. He was earning seven figures by the time he was 30. So for most people in the business world, you're doing pretty well. Mm-hmm. He drank what he calls the Hank Kool-Aid. In other words, he believed his own press. Mm-hmm. And he left a very successful finance business for a startup. And it failed the day that he left. Mm-hmm. He didn't do his research. Because sometimes when you get all arrogant, you just forget stuff that's basic stuff in business. You know, you do a research on a target company before you start joining them. So he ended up, his marriage broke up, and he ended up being in a, you know, small, fairly inexpensive hotel, you know, using the breakfast of the hotel to keep free breakfast to keep himself going. Mm-hmm. And so kind of what he learned, he started a finance business that's doing well, but this time his core values are gratitude and humility. He really treasures and treats his employees well. And so his attitude to life is very, very different. It's less about him, more about serving his customers and his employees. So, that's probably one example of
fascinating
thinking of life differently.
Fascinating. And then, you know, you also mentioned that one can turn a failure into a life of significance. Can you help me understand this with an anecdote or an example?
Yeah, I mean, I think maybe in my case, sometimes, you know, your purpose in life can come from the ashes of your own crucible. Mm-hmm. So in my case, I wrote a book and now have, you know, blog, social media, podcast, mm-hmm. all about how to live a life of significance, how to find your true calling. Well, that all came out of my experience. So sometimes out of tragedy can come your gift to the world. Another example, former Navy SEAL, David Charbonnet, he was injured in a parachuting training accident, became a quadriplegic. His whole purpose in life was gone. He was a very physically fit young man. This happened in his 20s. But through the rehab clinic in San Diego, California, he ended up, you know, finding his purpose. And now he's the executive director there. So that's sort of another example of out of his pain, which nobody would wish on anybody, he has found a purpose to help other veterans. So, yeah.
Incredible. Incredible. So let's talk a little bit about the crucible moment or the crucible process.
Well, basically, I think there's several steps. One is, you know, you've got to accept what you went through. It can be refining time. So when you go through a crucible, setback or failure, you can either hide under the covers and say, this was awful, it was unfair, like in the case of a tragic accident, or I lost this business, I'm an idiot, you know, I don't want to see another human because they will look down on me and just walk the other side of the street. Mm-hmm. You know, I'll be just this terrible person. And so you've got to learn the lessons from them. You know, many lessons that I learned, obviously, I wasn't living in light of who I was designed. I didn't listen to other family members. I mean, it's a long list of lessons that I went through. So learn those lessons. And then figure out, okay, how am I wired? You know, whatever religious or philosophical tradition, I believe we're designed a certain way. And if you're designed, whether it's artistic or mathematical, mm-hmm. live in light of that design, right? If you're an artist, why would you want to be a mathematician? If you're a mathematician, you know, why would you want to do something that doesn't use those skills? So, and then find a calling that you feel off the charts passionate about, that's grounded in your fundamental beliefs and values, mm-hmm. will make the world a better place. Mm-hmm. It's tough in business or any endeavor to be successful, but if you believe the world needs this and it's grounded in how you're wired, your fundamental beliefs and values, mm-hmm. it stands much more chance of succeeding.
Incredible. So let's now move on and talk a little bit about your podcast, Beyond the Crucible. Tell me about the podcast and what are the kind of topics that you talk about?
Yeah, I mean, we've had over 50 guests, as I mentioned, from every kind of failure and setback, from a business failure to abuse to paraplegia, Parkinson's disease, mm-hmm. every kind of challenge you can think of, from every background, gender. But what unites all of these stories is the same, is that they refuse to let their worst moment define their lives. They're using their pain for a purpose. They're thinking of others. And that seems to be the secret across all ages, genders, backgrounds, is just not hiding under the covers, waiting for the next 40, 50 years of your life to go away before it all ends. Mm-hmm. That's an option. Correct. The better option is to learn the lessons of what you went through mm-hmm. and use your pain in service of others. It's a universal way to at least maybe not get physical healing, but some degree of emotional and spiritual healing. That's true of all of the guests we've had on.
Amazing. So, you know, a question that is often asked from me, and I'm going to ask you the same question, is what goes into making a successful podcast?
A successful podcast? Well, you know, I don't know that I'm the expert, but I would say you want to have interesting guests and you want to be open and vulnerable. I'm all about authenticity. I try to be that myself, but you want to have, I think this is what you do, Ash. I mean, real people with real stories that people will be interested in. So in that sense, it's similar, is you want to have people that are authentic and vulnerable who are sharing their own lessons. Doesn't mean it's true for everybody, but it's their perspective, their truth, their lessons. And hopefully something will resonate with the folks that are listening saying, huh, that makes sense. I learned something today. So I think that's part of what you want, authentic, vulnerable people who have something to offer.
Correct. Well said. Well said. So let me now move to the last segment of our conversation, Warwick. A few questions for you personally. What would you say are three key milestones in your life or your career?
And the first one, yeah.
You want to talk about the billion-dollar company.
Well, yeah. I mean, obviously, the one was the launch and the loss, or the launch of the takeover and the loss of that. Mm-hmm. was you know, huge. It changed the direction of my life. The second was meeting my wife, who's American, who I met in mm-hmm. 1989, and well, you know, we got 88, and we got married in 89. So we've been married over 30 years. Having a partner in life who loves you unconditionally, that's a gift. Mm-hmm. And then kids. I mean, because of COVID, I've sort of three kids in their 20s, one just turned 30, who are actually living with us, which mm-hmm. is very unusual in America. But with COVID, you know, it just worked out that way. And, you know, we love having them. And really the third is sort of launching Crucible Leadership, is that sense of, you know, using my pain for a purpose. There is a healing component when you feel like you're making meaning out of tragedy. And again, that's another universal thing that everybody we've interviewed on the podcast. Mm-hmm. It doesn't make the pain go away, but giving meaning to things does help. So that was a huge milestone too.
Fabulous, fabulous. And you know, you mentioned a little while ago that you didn't want to believe, or you didn't want to take someone else's vision.
Yeah.
But I want to talk to you about values and
yes.
the fact that you pivoted so beautifully and landed on your feet and have reestablished yourself in a new country. What are some of the core values you believe in?
I think obviously grounded in my faith, but in terms of the values, it would be humility and integrity. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, I grew up in a large family business, and it's funny, Australia as a society is very egalitarian. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, if you're wealthy, you know, tend not to get a whole lot of credit on the playground. It's like, oh, you think you're better than us just because, you know, you're wealthy. And I'd say, no, I don't. I've mm-hmm. never had that attitude. Mm-hmm. I'm no better or worse than any other human being on the planet. So, mm-hmm. you know, humility is really, if you start believing that you're better than other people, you know, you're set for a fall. There's always somebody going to be better, quicker, faster than you, you know. So being the greatest of all time, which we wrote a blog on recently, that's a tough ask. There'll always be somebody that'll beat your record, no matter what it is. So humility and then integrity, which basically is do what you say you're going to do, tell the truth as far as you can, live a life that's in accordance with your values. So those humility and integrity are probably my two cornerstone values.
Amazing. And a follow-on question from there is, you know, as you look back at your absolutely incredible journey and from where you stand today, what does success mean to Warwick?
You know, we talk a lot about success and significance. To me, success is leaving a legacy that you and your family can be proud of. Mm-hmm. So let's say, you know, you're somehow magically able to see your own funeral and eulogy. Do you want people saying, oh, so-and-so made billions of dollars? Is that what it's about? Mm-hmm. Very few sane people will say that's what they want their legacy. Mm-hmm. Maybe they want to say, you know, I love dad or mom. They had a good relationship. They were people of integrity. They were people of compassion. So live your legacy today. And for me, success is living in light of that, is living a legacy today that you can be proud of. Very few people intentionally live outside of their values, but they do because they're not thinking about it. So, you know, just imagine what your funeral is going to be, and you want people to be proud of you. So what would that look like? You know,
this is such a fascinating, such an amazing answer. First time someone has told me that success is what's going to be written on your epitaph. So that's amazing. Thank you. Quite an amazing answer. My next question to you, Warwick, is who or what inspires you?
Well, probably not surprisingly, as a person of faith, and in my case, faith in Christ, it's really both sort of the model of Jesus, which not all Christians, I'd say, live in light of that. There's a quote that you're probably very familiar with by Gandhi that says, you know, I love your Christ, I'm not sure about Christians, something to that effect. And I think I have to agree with that. It's and a lot of people don't always live their values or their faith, but that sort of inspiration of servant leadership, of humility, I mean, it's easier said than done, but it's good to have role models who, when the bar is off the charts high, but one can at least in a small way try to emulate whoever our role models are. So yeah, I think it's good to have a role model that you, whether that's a faith one, somebody in business or life, somebody you want to emulate. It's helpful.
Very nice. So I've got time for two more questions for you. My next question, and you just spoke of role models. So my question is, if you were a role model to millions of children who closely followed you and your life choices, what is the one thing you would change in yourself?
You know, I'm impatient, but probably more than that, I'm pretty hard on myself. I know that's an issue. If I make a mistake or do something that maybe could have been done better, I tend to be kind of unsparing on myself. So I think really we're going to make mistakes. The mistakes is not the issue. It's what do you do about it? If you're short with your wife or your husband or kids, apologize, which I do try and do. Anecdotally, I find apologizing to my kids is a whole nother level than apologizing to your, you know, wife or husband. But, you know, just don't be so hard on yourself. When you make a mistake, fix it. You know, we're not defined, you know, if your sense of self-worth is about being perfect and not making mistakes, you're going to be in trouble because we're all going to make mistakes. So basically, I think we all need to cut ourselves a bit of slack. Doesn't mean don't make up for the messes you cause, but, you know, you can't just brutally, you know, be hard on yourself every time you fall short because we're all going to fall short. So give yourself a bit of slack.
Very interesting.
I suppose would be the message.
And my last question to you, Warwick, is on failure. I mean, from the part of the world that I come from, which is South Asia or Asia, parents don't teach children it's okay to fail. We're always taught to be first in class, go to the head of the line, etc. And that manifests itself in our behavior patterns. Yet we fail. My question to you is, what have been some of your learnings from some of your mistakes?
You know, I think it's not wrong to tell your kids, work hard, be responsible, especially from wealthy families. Mm-hmm. A lot of kids are not responsible. They drive fast cars, and incidentally, don't you give your kid some fast car. That's always a mistake. Yes. You know, if you're wealthy, you know, make them earn it. But, you know, it's okay to fail. I mean, most serial entrepreneurs have failed multiple times before they've found their success. Mm-hmm. So if you're not willing to fail, then you're not willing to succeed. Mm-hmm. And so as parents, I mean, you know, there's cataclysmic failures, there's levels of failures, but, you know, small wins, like in large businesses, often if they have a rising young person in their 20s and 30s, they give them some small little business unit. Mm-hmm. But if it fails, the company won't go under. But if they succeed, okay, you know, they give them little small places where they can, you know, see how they do. So you've, mm-hmm. it's okay to want your kids to do well, but when they fail, say, you know what, you tried hard. What lessons did you learn? Mm-hmm. What will you do better next time? But also give them the idea that your love for them, and this is key, certainly in a lot of cultures, your love for them does not depend on their success. Mm-hmm. If they feel that your love is conditional, your relationship with them is going to be fractured. So you wanting them to do well is fine. When they fail, if you tell them, look, I love you no matter what. I love you right or wrong. My love for you does not depend on your success. That's a huge thing that parents, I think, need to learn. You can do both. You can want your kids to do well and love them unconditionally. Both are possible.
What a great answer. Warwick, thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure speaking to you. I mean, thank you for sharing such an amazing journey you have had. And I just loved your definition of success. Thank you again and good luck.
Thanks so much, Ash. Wonderful to be here.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Brand Called You videocast and podcast, a platform that brings you knowledge, experience, and wisdom of hundreds of successful individuals from around the world. Do visit our website, www.tbcy.in, to watch and listen to the stories of many more individuals. You can also follow us on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Just search for The Brand Called You.